a new statewide test brings calls for a pause in accountability, a report on the real reason for a top departure at DCS, plus Buttigieg's ads aimed at DeVos, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 30th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, state leaders called for the state to hold off penalizing schools for major drops in scores on the new statewide ILEARN test. In a series of statements released Monday, General Assembly leaders and state officials, including Governor Eric Holcomb and State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, stressed the need to hold schools harmless for the results during the ILEARN exam's first year in use. Indiana schools moved from ISTEP to the new standardized test in 2017, and students first took the test earlier this year. Similar to other transitions in standardized testing, the scores went down. Results released to parents and schools this month show drops in student achievement in language arts and math, specifically. Test scores help drive teacher evaluations and school letter grades, so lower achievement has educators and parents across the state concerned. The previous transition to a new standardized test in Indiana prompted legislative action as well. In 2015, after then-Governor Mike Pence's decision to exit Common Core standards, ISTEP scores dropped across the state. Lawmakers then passed two bills in 2016 to hold harmless those scores from school and teacher evaluations. Is hold harmless for schools a no-brainer? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is this a pretty easy call for policymakers?
Who are we holding harmless? The students or the legislators and the State Board of Accounts and the governors who gave us this flawed system? Okay? This is the second time in 5 years, by my count, that we've thrown out a test we've spent tens of millions of dollars developing. There was a test that the governors agreed on, Mitch Daniels agreed on, until Mike Pence said, because President Obama thought it was a good idea, we can't do it in Indiana. We have to make up our own. We have to spend tens, 20, 30, 40 million dollars developing a test, which now we throw out for the second time in 5 years. And even if it had worked, and even if it did what it was supposed to do, the results come in too late to affect where the children are assigned for the year. The system is completely flawed. Who's being held harmless are the legislators and the State Board of Education who gave us these flaws and now are afraid of the political backlash from them.
One of the statements was from Bob Boehning, the chair of House Education, who said, you know, it's not the test scores that matter, it's the learning in the classroom. Is that kind of undermining the argument for the test at all?
Well, no, because I think what the test is trying to demonstrate is student growth. And so I think they should have probably included a hold harmless in this anyway, because you're measuring off the previous test. And so you're theoretically, you would have been measuring progress from ILEARN based on ISTEP, which is an apples and oranges comparison that they should have anticipated and not done this. Mm-hmm. Not done it this way. But they're not throwing the test out. They're establishing a baseline for measuring growth of these students in the future. And to do that, you need an apples-to-apples comparison in next year's test to see where the growth is.
Is the larger problem here that it's twice in 4 or 5 years? If this had been just the first time
Glenn Durant's fumbled the first one, so let's not forget who was in charge for that one.
And the State Board of Education wasn't there, and the governor wasn't there when that happened.
The goalpost is moving twice in that regard, but also you have other sorts of hiccups along the way where the test has to be delayed, the test has to be scrapped because certain things, the technology wasn't in place or functioning properly for certain school districts. And so you go back to... back to ISTEP you were referring,
back to Common Core.
Well, you're referring to Common Core.
Which everybody else uses.
Well, actually, you pointed out Mitch Daniels agreed to it. He and other Republican governors actually helped draft it and create it. So it was not some, you know, evil cabal of Democrats preaching.
No, it was an evil cabal of Republicans.
Rejected by Mike Pence.
So I think it's just notion that You know, think it's one thing in the classroom, but if let's talk about the workplace generally. If every year you go to work and you have an entirely different set of measurements against which, you know, that your raise depends on or your further employment depends on, I think people would get a little frustrated after a while.
Might be why we have a teacher shortage.
We've talked a lot about all of the issues surrounding this, and including this idea that increasingly teachers don't like the school grading system, they don't like how tied their teacher evaluations are to these scores. Does this give more fuel to that fire to call for the change in how we do this?
I mean, to me, it's the same fuel we've had for years, and no one's really backed away from it. I mean, I do think, you know, parents and students I feel for, because on one hand, they're being told, you have to be accountable, this test your performance, and we have to. And on the other hand, as soon as it drops, oh crap, we're not going to count it this year because it doesn't look good for people. And meanwhile, you've got Timmy and Johnny, you know, they still get a score that says they're a failure. So nothing that lawmakers do can take that away.
And they also get a check that says at sixth grade that they're not suitable for college. Okay, come on.
Well, but that's the whole point, right? So if we didn't measure accountability in Carmel for the next 10 years, almost every kid that comes out of Carmel High School is going to be career and college ready. The whole point was to look statewide, and especially in pockets of the state in Indianapolis and Gary and South Bend, and measure growth and see, are these failing schools, is it working at all for the kids who need it the most? And so we've tried to layer these programs and choice and all of these other things to get at kids that don't have access to a college and career.
So you take a standardized test with proven results that cost a fraction
spent. I'm fine with that. I would rather use a nationwide standard that is tried
we
and true.
We have to compete in the nation.
Everybody's using it, right. So there's a lot of experience and data to draw from.
What's so special about our students that we can't do
that? I can't unring that bell, Ann. I'm just one man.
I want a test that measures Hoosier common sense. Time now for viewer feedback.
I think that's what this show is all about.
Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, is Indiana too reliant on standardized test scores in driving teacher evaluations and school letter grades? A yes or B no. Last week's question, will Democrats capture the attorney general seat in 2020? 52% of you say yes, 48% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, a report from the Indy Star this week revealed the real reason behind the departure of Associate DCS Director Todd Meyer, inappropriate behavior towards an intern. Former Boone County Prosecutor Todd Meyer was brought to DCS in a newly created position to lead an overhaul of the agency in the wake of an independent investigation. He abruptly resigned last month, and Governor Holcomb at the time said it was for, quote, a better opportunity. But an Indy Star report revealed an intern at DCS had reported Meyer to Human Resources for a series of inappropriate comments and text messages. The texts were not sexually explicit, but he said he wanted to hang out with the intern and asked about her, quote, scent. Holcomb now says he's disgusted by Meyer's actions and that he's no longer able to work for the state. Mike O'Brien, why was this all done so privately? Why did it take a media report to out this stuff?
Why did we not inflict as much political damage in anticipation of a media report maybe coming out? That's the question. No, look, I did agree with one part of the Indy Star article. I think it was the end of it, that they've interviewed a professor at Indiana University who said, you know, the guys kind of get to be off the hook. They get let go. They get to kind of quietly leave and move on. We've had so many of these circumstances, and they're bipartisan, right? So this isn't a partisan behavior problem. It's a human behavior problem. And it maybe needs to be dealt with a little more out in the open, and don't let these guys kind of just move on to the next thing. I'm not trying to be too critical, because in politics, and this is, again, a bipartisan, this is how both parties and everyone approaches it. You try to minimize damage, sweep it away, protect. If it's the elected official, you try to protect them. If it's the elected official doing the action, you try to save them, right? If it's your guy or my guy.
Or at the very least, save the party.
Or at the very least, try to minimize the damage or isolate the damage. But that just allows this kind of, and it's everywhere. I mean, it's in the private sector. Businesses do this. They try to minimize risk, and I think that culturally needs to change.
By all accounts, the system worked in the department the way it should. A complaint was made. He immediately left. Is the problem that we should have known about that, even if not right away?
I think the problem is the culture, and I don't just mean the culture of corruption. I mean the culture. When you have a president of the United States that acts the way that he acts towards women, and you have an attorney general of the state of Indiana that acts the way he acts towards women, it makes people think that that is standard procedure, that that's okay. And there's something wrong with that perception. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with that perception. It used to be in the rape context. Fortunately, it has tempered off a little bit, but I'll tell you, it still happens in our college campuses, and it happens regularly to women in college campuses. And the idea that you would think that from a position of power that you could do the kinds of things that the president does and the attorney general does and this DCS does to employees shows that there's something wrong with the entire culture.
Governor Hogan was pretty forthright about what he thought about this yesterday when he spoke to the press about it. But again, should that have happened before a media report?
Yeah, I think this is starting to be a real problem because just like Curtis Hill, like all the people inside knew and they were just keeping it quiet. And something that Governor Holcomb said a couple times yesterday, which was we have to remember that there's a victim involved here. But I think there's got to be some sort of middle ground that still protects the victim.
And the victim and, was you in know, the story. She was interviewed in
and,
the story.
And maybe you just put out a two-sentence saying, you know, a complaint was levied against him by a fellow employee. He has chosen to resign. I mean, that at least lets people know there's something out there and, you know, he's not going for a better opportunity, as the governor initially said. And so I think we've got to balance the
Well, he probably was going to a better opportunity had this played itself out.
The governor said that the reason he said, and it was actually me that he told that to, that he thought the reason Meyer left was for a better opportunity was because that was what was in the resignation letter. And I believe that, even though we still haven't seen the resignation letter. But separate from that, A guy who's been at the agency for a year is leading an overhaul of that agency, suddenly, boom, up and resigns, no warning, no notice, says, I've got something better going on. Even if you're, I mean...
Your gut should have told you something.
Why wasn't it...
He even left elective office, did he not, to take the job?
Yeah.
So, I mean, an office that he had aggressively sought and won.
As served a prosecutor. For a while.
Prosecutor. Your question, I interrupted you.
No, it was... Shouldn't that have raised questions for the governor at the time?
The answer is yes.
I think it should have. Because of the agency's background and the troubles we've seen here over the past, 2 years, year and a half, since the previous director left.
It would be different if it were the Department of Revenue.
I would say so, because what happens when you...
No,
when you
it shouldn't
play,
be different.
Well,
I,
it shouldn't no, be, no, but no. What
I'm
been?
Just saying here, this compounds the problem of a lack of transparency. When you have an agency where there were documented problems. We spent hired a consultant from out of state to come in and give us voluminous
to
reports
document those
on all of those problems, and everybody committed to trying to make it better. So in
which
that agency...
Is, which it is getting better.
Right,
getting better.
In that agency, absolutely. When you have somebody that leaves under the circumstances with the timeline and the surprise factor that you described, Brandon, that just leads to questions like...
Even more questions.
And so, I understand the whole notion of, hostile workplace, sexual harassment. I think the knee-jerk reaction, certainly in the private sector, and probably the HR community generally, even in the public sector, is, you know, there's a victim, let's just play it close to the vest. But that doesn't work in this instance.
It ends up protecting...
It doesn't work in the private instance either.
Because when they play it
close to the vest, what happens is the victim leaves and the perpetrator stays. That's what happens. And you can handle this
elsewhere.
You can handle this perfectly separate, as you say, with the victim. You don't have to release her name unless she wants her name released. The Star, for years, would report on rapes without reporting the victim's name.
And again, in this story, she was identified as an intern, but we don't know who she is.
That's right, and that's good. But that doesn't mean you can't make the story public.
What I argued, and maybe I didn't say it the right way, our approach generally politically is protection. It's play it close to the vest. But it never works. So you do it a different way.
Right.
Oh, my God, we all agree.
Wow.
Shocking.
Democratic presidential hopeful and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg this week released Facebook ads attacking Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos and got a little boost from the top Hoosier education official. Buttigieg's ads focus on higher education and student debt, criticizing DeVos's Department of Education for rolling back Obama-era consumer protection measures for student borrowers. DeVos cut $13 billion from a debt relief program, and during the Trump administration, the Department of Education eliminated requirements that for-profit colleges prove they're helping their graduates get jobs. The online ads feature an oft-repeated line from Buttigieg's campaign stops.
I believe freedom comes by way of education, which is why it's time for a Secretary of Education who actually believes in public education.
That line drew a supportive response from Indiana State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick, who on Twitter said, quote, "And the fact that this now needs stating is telling." John Schwanes, can Betsy DeVos be a weak point for Donald Trump in 2020?
Well, I'm not sure how far out the Teflon-coated bubble of impunity that seems to surround the Oval Office, how far that goes in terms of cabinet officials. I don't think overall, because there's so many issues at play here, from health care to immigration to the economy and tax policy, that this is necessarily going to be a front burner issue for the electorate as a whole. Yeah. However, it actually plays well with the very constituency or demographic segment that Pete Buttigieg is strongest with, which is young people. Yeah. And you look at the millennials and the people, their number one issue, you know, everybody else may say it's you know, immigration, it's healthcare education, costs. It's healthcare costs. You talk to the group that he is strongest with, which is, again, Democrats of a certain age, the millennials and maybe Gen Xers. These are the people who are struggling with that, you know,
they're
in some cases.
They're not the only people struggling.
Debt, but,
no,
but they're the ones.
Debt.
They're the ones for.
With student debt.
Yeah, right,
no,
but they're the
right.
ones for whom this is, a defining
a
issue.
Well,
so
me,
for that constituency, yes, but overall, I don't think it plays.
I think, yeah. So can DeVos be a weak point for Trump?
I kind of find it an odd, you know, thing to go after an individual cabinet member instead of the president. So, I mean, I guess you got to try all, you know, you got to try all different, you know, I guess, strategies to see what works, but I don't consider it to be, you know, a really
good I want to ask about McCormick, though. So McCormick lends her voice into this issue. Mm-hmm. there's obviously a lot going on with Jennifer McCormick outside of anything she might have against Betsy DeVos or Donald Trump. So what do you make of, or Republicans generally, what do you make of her inserting herself into this?
I think what she's doing is looking at the people that she's supposed to be helping get educated and realizing that this is an issue. And it's not just an issue for the younger people. The number of people 50 and over with significant student loan debt who are retiring and facing bankruptcy and still having those student loan debts survive even when they're for-profit institutions is an issue, and it's a growing issue. There, the number of people over 50, $30 billion in student loan debt, okay? It is an issue that it goes beyond younger people.
Generation.
And it is an important issue to address. And that's what he's doing, because her policies are hurting those people. Hardship discharge and all of the other things that the Obama administration made available, she's taking back. And that's hurting people.
The cynical amongst us might question whether this from Jennifer McCormick is another tryout for a candidacy of lieutenant governor.
I'm not going to spitball what her future career plans are, but I hope that this is. I think student loan debt is a real issue politically. It is going to be a front center issue in 2020. I hope Republicans remind everybody why we're here. Democrats in 2010 nationalized student loans. They've doubled since then. They're either half of them are in forbearance, deferral, some kind of income matching program to reduce your payment, or they're just straight delinquent. And when the federal government took this over, it was pitched as a profit center to help pay for Obamacare. It was built into the finances, all of this. And now this year, instead of earning the $60 billion that the federal government was supposed to make on it, we're going to lose $32 billion. And that's precisely because, in a direct line from the decisions that were made by the Obama administration to encourage and create all these safety hatches to not repay it. And college has gotten more expensive, graduation rates are down, and we've doubled this debt in 10 years.
And institutions have exploited every bit of that.
I don't disagree
with
that.
And that's a good part of the problem.
Moving on, economists are warning that a downturn in shipments of recreational vehicles from Elkhart County, the RV capital of the world, suggests a recession could be around the corner. More than 80% of RVs sold in the U.S. are produced in Indiana, and roughly 65% of those come from Elkhart, and wholesale shipments are down about 20% so far this year. Ball State economist Michael Hicks says consumers don't buy RVs and other big-ticket items when money is tight, so economists watch for declines in the RV sector and a slowdown in auto sales as signs the economy is worsening. Elkhart County Economic Development Corporation CEO Chris Steger says he prefers to stay positive about the situation.
Nikki Kelly, how worried should Hoosiers and especially those in the Elkhart area be?
I mean, I think everyone should be worried. I mean, A, the RV industry has been a reliable harbinger in the past, but also we are in the middle of the longest economic period between recessions in history. So, you know, the average, I think, economic growth period is 3 years, and we're at like 10. So it's going to come. I mean, it's only a question of what month.
And this is not, we've been saying this for a little while, it's now that the numbers are starting to really tick in that direction. And I've got to ask about the politics of this. How worried should current office holders, regardless of party, be?
I think very worried. You don't have to read the tea leaves. You can look at the data. You can talk to people who know a lot more about these things than I do. And they say you have, for all the reasons that Nikki spelled out, but then you also have it's exacerbated by the tariff battle and a lot of the international trade fights, which is adding, is also probably fueling inflation in certain categories where we're seeing, you know, something like winter coats are up, I think, 30% because of the nation of origin. And I think we shouldn't forget how painful that part of the state, what pain it endured. Yeah. When the rest of the state rebounded after the stimulus package and after the worst of the recession, and things started to come back, they were still in St. Joe and Elkhart.
They were hit first. They were hit hardest.
Right,
and they still had.
Remember, they had unemployment rates of 21, 22% when the rest of the state was down maybe below 10. So. There's a certain sensitivity, I think, that people need to pay attention to.
There's always the unknowable X factor of a national election, the issue that we can't necessarily predict. Is this it?
Well, yeah, we're doing our best to talk ourselves into it. There are a couple red flags, but I think there was a suggestion a week or two ago that the payroll tax would be good. The president was going to promote this payroll tax, and I think, you know, with the Wall Street Journal and other kind of leaders on the conservative economic side of the ideological scale said, if you want to forego a recession, give markets predictability that people that are producing food or whatever have markets to sell to. And this, as this trade fight drags on, it just lets this uncertainty fester that these companies may not be able to have a market to actually sell to. So leave tax cuts alone and give us certainty in the marketplace.
In this tariff fight, a lot of people who back President Trump and are being hurt by these tariffs have so far said, listen, he's got a long-term strategy, we're sticking with him.
Yeah, well,
if the economy really takes a turn,
he's got a problem. And the problem is exacerbated by the policies domestically that he's followed. Not only do we have the tariffs out there, which are hurting manufacturing and hurting farming, and it will ultimately hurt consumers when they purchase their winter coats, et cetera, but in addition, the two ways you counter recession are by spending. And the deficit has exploded under Donald Trump. Those taxes that were going to pay for themselves, guess what? They haven't. And then on top of that, interest rates are supposedly cut. With pressure from him, the interest rates have been cut. So there's nowhere to go on the interest rates, and there's nowhere to go to federal spending. So when the recession hits, it's going to hit hard, and it's going to hit him at the same time.
Well, quarterback Andrew Luck stunned Indianapolis Colts fans and the football world this week when he announced his retirement at age 29. The news broke while Luck stood on the sidelines for the Colts preseason game at Lucas Oil Stadium. He was showered with booze as he walked off. After the game, he called it the hardest decision of his life, and the former number one overall draft pick says he's been in a cycle of, quote, injury, pain, rehab the last 4 years.
And I felt stuck in it, and the only way I see out is to no longer play football. It's taken my joy of this game away.
Luck had sat out so far this preseason because of a nagging leg issue that seemed to evade diagnosis. Mike O'Brien, I want to ask first about the fans. Now, we're Bears fans. We've been disappointed by quarterbacks for a very long time. But was it wrong of them to boo as he walked off the field?
Yeah, as Bears fans, we boo on a weekly basis. They're winning, for a lot less. I think the clumsiness with which all this came out, I think, was what was part of the reaction. I was at the game that night, and it was just a mixture of stunned, just disbelief that was actually happening. So I think if they had to do it over again, I think Andrew Luck was going to catch heck for this one way or the other. Yeah. If he waited all season, if he did it in the middle of the year, there's always some angle that he's not taking bonus money or something.
Was the booing maybe less about Andrew Luck specifically and more about the whole situation, which extends to the Colts organization?
You know, who knows? Maybe it was just a function of too much beer at the game. I don't know what the
problem
was.
Saturday night.
Yeah, but it was tacky. And, you know, you can't fault him for wanting to walk and be able to raise his child and be able to lift the child up when the child is born. I mean, I don't know why anybody plays professional football, frankly. I mean, I understand the money, but what you're doing to your body is just incredible. You're killing yourself in by inches way before your time. So I give him credit for having the judgment to step back.
And it's not like he didn't have other options. He's a Stanford-educated architect. I think that changes the math a little, too.
Oh, totally. He has a completely, you know, open future for him. I just think people were frustrated with how it came out. And frankly, that's on the Colts.
Yeah.
Thinking he could tell people right. on Thursday that they were retiring, it would hold till Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.